This is Unsettled, Alaska Native Land Claims at 50. I'm Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media.
And I'm Aaron Leggett, the senior curator at the Anchorage Museum and the president of the Native Village of Aklutna.
For this episode of Unsettled, we're talking about subsistence, the hunting and fishing and other practices that Alaska Natives, particularly in rural Alaska, depend on for their survival. First, we're going to play a story about how subsistence intersects with the Alaska Native corporations that ANCSA created, and then we'll be back to talk with two advocates who have worked in this realm.
For this story, Nat took a trip to Northwest Alaska to look at how a mining company is working with NANA, the regional corporation for the Northwest Arctic, to explore a big new copper deposit. If built, the project could create hundreds of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars in wages. But the mine and a new 200-mile road needed to support it would profoundly change one of the state's most remote regions, where residents still depend on subsistence harvests, and the residents along the upper Kobuk River are deeply ambivalent about it.
It's a quiet late summer evening in Northwest Alaska, and a young couple, Jeremy and Frances Williams, are upstream of their home village of Ambler, pulling into an eddy on the upper Kobuk to haul up their subsistence net. Over the side, one at a time, flop a half dozen pink and chum salmon, the start of their yearly harvest. This evening, we're the only boat out on the river, which is rich with salmon and sheafish. Like many other residents along the upper Kobuk, the Williamses depend on subsistence foods like these for a huge share of their diet.
Because we haven't even bought chicken for how long? I can't even remember.
3-4 years maybe?
Yeah. Our kids don't like chicken.
I mean, like chicken nuggets.
Oh, yeah, that one, but not chicken or beef. Oh, not beef.
It's peaceful and quiet out here as the boat drifts downstream. But there's a shadow hanging over this whole scene, an industrial-scale mining project and proposed 200-mile road that would cut through wilderness to near the villages just upstream.
If it happens, it happens.
I don't want it to, though.
Yeah.
It's going to change everything.
It's all changed in migration, pretty much. And I don't know. Just got to wait and see what they do.
I hope they don't.
You can find this kind of anxiety about the mine and road scattered all across the three different upper Kobuk villages, particularly among young people. The next day, after a boat ride to Shungnak, the next village upriver, I run into some teenagers, among them Bryant's son, a 17-year-old who's into both basketball and subsistence, and who's not into the mine and the road.
Yeah, I mean, it'll make things easier for sure, but then with hunting and everything going on, and my dad has land just a few miles back there. Traffic that'll be going through there with all that equipment and stuff going up there, it'll just scare everything off.
While Sun opposes the project, he says his dad sees things differently. And as it happens, we find his dad the next day. There's no road to the mining prospect from Shungnak, so Ambler Metals, the company developing the project, came to get us in a helicopter. The company's main camp is tucked back in the mountains above the Kobuk Valley. Helicopters head out from here to support crews drilling core samples from cliffside scaffolds. Groceries and fuel have to be flown in. After we land and take a walking tour, we head into the rec tent to meet with Fred's son, Bryant's father. Fred works here on a maintenance crew, using skills he acquired at another big mine in the region, Red Dog. Unlike his son, Fred supports this new project, but that doesn't mean he's any less connected to the land. He's an avid subsistence hunter, fisherman, and berry picker with two cabins on the Kobuk, one upriver and one downriver from his village. But as Fred says, people don't hunt by dog team anymore. They use modern tools like boats and guns that you need cash to pay for. And that's why Fred is not very sympathetic to his son Bryant's point of view that the mine and road shouldn't be built. Fred says Bryant hasn't had to work yet and that everything's come to him for free.
When you're Bryant's age, you know you don't really have bills to worry about or house payments and things like that. He's never even bought a gun before, and he uses guns all the time. He doesn't realize everything he uses to help fill our freezer costs money.
This is the heart of the debate about the mine and road and about what's best for the three upper Kobuk villages. This region is one of Alaska's most isolated. There's no road access, and fish and game are relatively plentiful. But what happens if the new road brings in competition from urban hunters? What if there's an accident at the mine that contaminates the river? But if those sound like existential challenges, Fred says these villages already face some of those. Gas costs $10 a gallon. High-paying jobs and housing are scarce. More than half the members of Shungnak's tribe are outside the region, Sun says.
I have so many friends and relatives that live in Fairbanks or Anchorage who would rather live in Shungnak, but there are just no opportunities there. There's no work there. The cost of living is too high.
The region's other big mine, Red Dog, has helped sustain Northwest Alaska villages with high-paying jobs and dividends through a unique partnership with NANA, the regional native corporation that owns the land the mine sits on. But Red Dog only has about a decade of ore left, and the only village downstream has objected to its impacts for decades. Unlike Red Dog, the main Ambler mining prospect is on state land, not native land. But NANA still has a stake in it through an agreement with the Ambler Metals Company. Ambler Metals President Ramzi Fawaz says the project won't be built without what he calls social license from residents, which the company is still working to get.
Nothing is can taken for granted. We would like to have social acceptance. We would like to maintain social acceptance. And we like to continue to work on it and improve it.
For now, there doesn't seem to be a consensus about the project in the Upper Kobuk villages. Some people are reserving judgment or think their opinion won't matter, in spite of what the company says. Critics and supporters don't seem to be able to bridge their differences, even within families or couples, like Lisa Lee and Alan Tickett in Shungnak. Ticket is an equipment operator at Red Dog.
I don't want it.
Good job.
It's gonna mess up the caribou migration. That's our way of.
No, but everybody in Ambler needs jobs, though.
No, but that's what we live on.
See,
caribou.
Guys,
it's gonna mess up our caribou migration.
Sounds like you guys have difference of opinion here.
Yep.
Well, cause he's the operator, but I'm his girlfriend, so. I live off the land.
No, she lives off my money.
Sure.
The mine's construction, if it happens, is still years away. And environmental groups have also sued to challenge the federal government's environmental approvals for the road. The lawsuit has not yet been decided. So we have two guests on this episode. Here with us is Pete Schaefer, who is the chair of Kotzebue's tribal government. He's worked in his professional career at NANA, and he's also spent years working on subsistence issues in the Northwest Arctic. And if I don't have this wrong, I think Pete lives in Ivik when he's not in Kotzebue, which is an off-grid kind of settlement outside of Kotzebue where he and others live off the land.
And Mike Miller is a member of Sitka's Tribal Council. He's worked in the logging industry in Southeast, and he's also spent years advocating on subsistence issues in his region, including on the Sitka area herring and herring egg harvest and other marine mammal issues.
Thanks for being here, you guys. We're hoping to launch into a discussion, and I guess would ask if you guys had any reactions to the themes that you heard in that story.
Well, you know, it's almost everyday discussion, you know, when we start talking about development versus the importance of traditional foods and I guess the term subsistence is to folks around the state and you know, the further north, it's a oil discussion, and then there's mining and commercial fisheries, I guess, and trawlers with the CDQ groups, and comes all the way down to timber issues down in Southeast. So, I think ever since ANCSA, it's been an issue, right? And I don't know if there is a true fix from my standpoint. And granted, my background is in resource development, but I've spent over 20 years advocating for subsistence too. And that balance is a real change, but unless you, even if you don't agree, I guess, unless you can get people around the table to have discussions, you just end up with these opposing sides, you know, and it's really hard to progress past anything at that point. So yeah, we can go into all kinds of details, but I just, that's my quick takeaway.
And Pete, I'm curious, Mike, I think, was kind of talking about the idea of conflict in this area. And that was the way that I sort of approached the stories that I was doing about mining in the NANA region originally, that sort of there's a tension between resource development and subsistence. I was very quickly corrected on that idea and assumption by the folks at NANA who said, you know, you can't have subsistence without resource development here because otherwise people don't have a means of paying for gas, paying for their guns, paying for ammunition. So I guess I'm curious, how do you see those two issues sort of interrelating? Are they in tension or do they interrelate in another way?
Well, it's turned out to be extremely complex. As everybody knows, the first sentence in the Alaska Native Claims Settlements Act was something to the effect that Congress basically extinguished any claim to Native rights, common if such thing ever existed. And I think from the perspective of the Native community, that was a pretty racist thing to do. But given the political climate and who was in politics at the time, I think it is understandable that, you know, they did a lot of lobbying to do our traditional hunting and gathering practices away to a point where, in fact, back in the 80s, our Fish and Game Advisory Committee took it upon themselves to do a 16-page paper called The Impacts of Regulations in Northwest Alaska that were aimed directly at our culture. I think that hearing the comments from the folks up the river, it's no surprise. The same comments happened when the discussion of Red Dog was taking place. The first three annual meetings that we had was the question to the shareholders to whether they wanted a mine in the area. At first they said, hell no. Then the next year they said, well, maybe no. And then in the third year, after they had thought of it, looked at the potential impacts of what the road, which is pretty much insulated from any other road, it's a lone road, then I think putting some subsistence protections in place basically convinced the people that, well, for the reasons stated, especially by some of those folks up the river, that they need cash. I think that, you know, the Red Dog mine finally got the green light to proceed. But the big difference between that one and the Ambler Road project is that it's a lot longer road and it has the potential to really disrupt the cultural ways of life that people that depend on the caribou, because the proposed road routing goes right through the heart of caribou country, and that's basically the birthing grounds. So we've been keeping track of some of the opposition to the road, as well as our corporation and its interesting stance on being a partner in the development, because for years they were claiming that basically the road was secondary to, you know, being profitability and all that kind of stuff. But I think in relation to what the proposed Ambler Road will do is, as I said before, the disruption of the caribou. And then on the overall bigger picture, Sikatvi is, you know, 160 miles from Ambler. But we share all the same concerns as Inupiaq people that we treasure most, if not all, of our cultural teachings of both the hunting, the gathering, and the spiritual components of what we're all about. And to see a Red Dog Road was one thing where it pretty much demonstrated what really happens when a new facility is built, and that when it's first started in the development stage, you have an influx of outsiders that will pretty much take up all of the space employment-wise until the specialties begin to have an opportunity for shareholders to be trained. And given that Red Dog has also trained some shareholders, I think that instead of having about a 5% participation rate as what happened in Red Dog as a local force, just most, mainly laborers and, you know, service industry level jobs, I think the Ambler employment opportunities are much larger in scale. What we're trying to do along with my tribe is the native village of Kotzebue actually did a resolution in opposition to the road project simply because of the cultural concerns that we know will happen. And most of the paperwork we see nowadays that's mailed out and everything else is, you know, saying what a great project there is, what a great employment opportunity for our shareholders will be, and all that kind of stuff. But very little, if any, on what some of our Inupiaq elders know for sure that will probably happen related to more loss of our Inupiaq culture. So that's an extreme worry for us.
Do you think that there is a way that you can balance economic development in the regions with subsistence? I mean, I think a lot of people point to Red Dog as being rather successful, and one of the reasons it's attributed to that is the fact that the mine is on Nana land, and if it was on state land, perhaps the project would have been done at a much larger scale and much quicker.
Well, I don't know, but the original site when Red Dog started is already depleted, and at the time they projected that as a 50-year project, but it only lasted about 30 years. And the isolation of that particular project was such that everything from the mining activity to the transportation to the port site to ships was a pretty singular thing. There is no connecting road anywhere near it. So the social concerns were such that, you know, it wasn't as major of impacts we see on the AMBLA road project. Because our experience, for example, of the highway that it connects to the Dalton, basically it was promised to be an industry road only, but it only took a lawsuit to fix that little problem.
I'd be curious to sort of follow up that question, and maybe this is one for Mike. A lot of what I've heard about this issue of subsistence and natural resource development sort of comes back to the fact that you have native corporations that were specifically created for the purposes of developing lands and making money. And I wonder, do you guys ever think about how much of that tension is a result of ANCSA creating for-profit corporations? If there was a different model of land ownership and who owned and controlled the land, would that make a difference for how these issues are playing out?
At first blush, I don't think so. I think you're always going to have this kind of, there's people that are going to be working with developers and that's just kind of their mindset, and I think the two arguments would still be there. It's like how do you balance, and when we're talking about places that do have, you know, struggle with economy, when there's the offer of good jobs, even if it doesn't isn't immediately followed through on, you know, people hear that and they're concerned about being able to stay there, right? But then there's the other side, and they're absolutely valid points. It's very important that you know, the culture of the community, especially as it relates to harvesting traditional foods and the cultural connection to that, is so easily upset, right? And not only just from the extraction of the natural resources, but as Pete was talking about, the influx of people that come in that kind of put additional pressures on folks. So I think regardless whether it's the corporation status versus the tribes or who owned the land, you would still be running into those issues from my standpoint.
What's your thought on that, Aaron?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think the difference is if the land was in the hands of the tribes, there would be some federal protections when it comes to subsistence. But the trade-off would be anytime you did want a project where you did want to develop it, you would have to go to the Department of the Interior, the Bureau of Indian Affairs to deal with it. And we know that things like where the community supports it, like the Eisenbeck Road between Cold Bay and King Cove, that's been in court for years because of concerns from conservationists about putting a road. But the people in the community are saying we're having people dying by not being able to go, you know, by having this land trade. So those kinds of issues will only be amplified, I think, had we went with a different route.
Mike and Pete, you guys are both, you know, I think doing a lot of work in this realm of sort of advocating around subsistence. I think it was Mike, we were having a conversation last week about how much Native corporations sort of relate to that work. How are Native corporations actually involved in the conversations and the work around protecting subsistence rights? Or is that sort of like almost a world that's totally separate from the corporate world and is work that has to be taken on by other entities?
Well, actually, it's become a major concern as to where our corporation is going, simply because back in the 70s, as we formed a corporation and elected a board, it was mostly the traditional leaders that served on the board. Now here it is, you know, 2020, and a lot of those people have passed away, if not all. And I think that that's of major concern, that we now have in our corporation college-educated administrators, which is a good thing. But then the concern now is starting to reveal itself in the fact that, you know, you can go out to college, wherever, Stanford or whatever, but the real college of hard knocks is the past way of life here that took a high degree of skills that it took to succeed as a hunter and that kind of thing, which is why I think the mindset of the elders we're still dealing with, trying to figure out how to integrate into our educational system some of our identity, which is turning out to be a major concern, because as we go on through our generations, what we're trying to do is instill some of those values into our children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren that we feel is very important. But then at the same time, as our elders pass away, it's like we lose a part of our encyclopedia of that kind of knowledge. So, you know, it's a very tough issue.
It's a challenge. You know, I can't speak for all the regions of the state, but in Southeast here, we've got a cool thing with the herring egg issue here, because it's kind of one place to get them, right? And so we can't really fight with other regions or other, even amongst ourselves. When it's time to get them, you have to work together. And we go to forums to advocate for subsistence. And I found it pretty vital to have as many big supporters in a system that's not geared towards just the tribes and your traditional tribal folks. They're not necessarily fair forums for that, right? And we wish it'd be a different world, you know, that was more fair, but it's not. And we do have to work in the world that's presented to us, unfortunately, at times on some marine mammal issues and definitely herring issues and other fishery issues. We've relied pretty heavily on the bigger names of the regional corporation and also the village corporation. And I sit on the tribal council. I'm a member, you know, the village corporation and the regional. And there's a lot of times we don't get along very well on particular issues. But, you know, when we're out getting eggs in the spring, I'll be in my boat and there'll be a village corporation board member next boat over and a regional corporation person in the next boat. And there's a lot of times we don't get along over the course of the year, but we help each other out when we're out doing that. And so I think it's really important. Again, it's just my experience in Southeast here, that we try to utilize to the extent possible. And when the corporations are willing to help out on subsistence issues, it really is a great gift to the people, because we're representing kind of all the same people, right? And they do bring some ammunition to the table that as tribes alone, we don't have. And not everybody agrees with that. A lot of people, there are people that are uncomfortable with it, but in my experience, that's been the most successful.
Alaskans have debated subsistence and fish and wildlife and game management for decades. If you guys had to identify, maybe starting with Mike, there clearly are subsistence-related issues that were left unresolved or even made worse by ANCSA. If those were going to be resolved, what's maybe the most critical issue you would say is still sort of left outstanding?
Can I let Pete answer first.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, in our experience with the feds, you know, we've had the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which has a native exemption built into it, and that worked great. The unfortunate part is that Alaska, since its birth as a state, intended to be a hunter's paradise at the exclusion of anything to do with Native people. We could probably spend another 2 hours just talking about the inequities that, you know, happened at, you know, the Constitutional Convention had 55 delegates and only one was an Alaska Native, and so on and so forth. But I think in our experience here, without a Native exemption, it's gone to a rural resident, and that has resulted in extreme user conflicts up here to a point where we're almost afraid that something might explode here with the commercial hunters. We had, in our Fish and Game Advisor paper, we had pointed out that there were, at the time, 222 or 227 guides authorized to operate in Game Management Unit 23, which is pretty much the NOTAC and COBOC and the solid drainages, if you look at the GMU map of the state of Alaska. And the user conflicts have been addressed formally in a series of meetings with all of the stakeholders, commercial guides, commercial transporters, and the native community and the federal landowners. And basically, it came down to the realization that the real problems are the Alaska State Constitution and ANILCA. ANILCA, for example, had some protections for subsistence, which we like to call better as the traditional hunting and gathering activities, to a point now where, you know, as an example, muskox pretty much hogged the area in a place called Sisolik across here at the expense of people able to harvest their traditional gathering for, you know, greenery and berries and stuff like that. And basically, the muskox is under the protection of the state and the Park Service system. So, you know, those user conflicts will be exacerbated in this Ambler area simply because if a road is built there, then you're going to have, you know, landings in the upper river. So if people think that we have a user problem now, after the Ambler Road is built and people come in there, you know, not only aircraft, but airboats and shallow water craft and all that, then the traditional hunting spots, which have been honored for centuries, have not only disappeared, but with the NOTAC National Preserve, we have basically, we estimate somewhere between 400 to 600 hunters that come in. We call them Cabela's Army, and basically hog the drainages up there that, in fact, we allege that they disrupt the caribou migration. And of course, in every meeting, including lately the Board of Game meetings, it's an issue that just won't go away, that is virtually impossible to fix. That's our major concern.
How about for you, Mike?
Well, just listening to Pete give his concerns, and, you know, granted, I'm newer to the discussion since, you know, it was late 90s when I really got involved in advocacy. But there's so many. You know, we're an entire state of a patchwork of different management regimes. They're not consistent between federal and state rules. At least the federal system does have some rural preferences for folks and seems to be a bit more geared towards addressing those. The state system, you know, it is frustrating to see such a well-organized sport and guided sport lobby that works really good with administrations and the board processes. And again, the processes are not, they're not geared to your average tribal person for the way they communicate. So I fear that, you know, unless we're really organized to attend most of those meetings, we stand to go backwards. Because every meeting where there's a resource being discussed, there's outside groups that are talking about how to divvy it up for them, right? And so our communities get kind of left out a lot of times. I don't know a system that doesn't need a whole bunch of work right now. And that is for the folks doing it, it is a challenge to even keep up on where we're at on stuff. So I see some initiatives to try to bring the statewide group, but there's a lot of pressure too, because a lot of folks get kind of adopted by some of the outside interests, some of the conservation groups. And I always urge people that it's fine to work with, you know, outside folks, but we're the ones that need to lead the discussion though, and not become a poster child for somebody's other vision of what fish and game use in the state should look like.
Aaron, you have anything you want to add here?
No, I mean, I think it is a complex issue. I mean, we have a state that's currently set up in, you know, rural and non-rural areas. You know, for my people in the native village of Aklutna, you know, we're surrounded by the municipality of Anchorage. So for me, any thoughts of subsistence went out the door before World War II and my grandmother's generation. It's a very different kind of take that we have.
It's kind of crazy. Like, the municipality of Anchorage says, like, you can't fire a gun in the Anchorage Bowl, right? So does that mean you guys can't fire a gun?
Correct. Yeah. There's a few exemptions, and you get out towards the flats near the village, you can, but again, there's no hunting seasons. And the way it's designated, I was looking at a map one time, and the federal regulations say that somebody, if they're living out past Willow and go onto federal property in this area, they can qualify as a rural resident. But us being in Aklutna or in Anchorage, we'll never qualify for that. So it's very convoluted. We're going to end this episode with one more story from Nat's series that touches on subsistence. For this piece, Nat took a trip to Northwest Alaska to see one of the largest existing zinc and lead mines in the world. Red Dog is a unique partnership between a multinational mining company and NANA, the regional corporation of the Northwest Arctic. Its boosters describe the mine as a model, allowing Native Corporation shareholders to balance subsistence lifestyle with participation in the cash economy. But as Nat reports, it's not certain how long the ride will last.
Alongside a road below Red Dog Mine's big tailings pond and mill, Tristan Petit leads me trudging through a soggy patch of shrubs. Petit works in Red Dog's environmental department, and he's taking me to a place that commands a lot of their attention, the bottom end of a culvert with a stream of water pouring out.
This right here is all treated water from the whole process from the mill, and then it gets discharged here.
Petit is on Red Dog's payroll, but this is not exactly a normal job. As a shareholder in NANA Regional Corporation, Petit is also an owner of the land the mine sits on. That's one reason he was able to start working at Red Dog without a college degree. Under a deal NANA negotiated with the mine's operator decades ago, Red Dog gives a hiring preference to NANA shareholders, so long as they meet the minimum qualifications for a job. Petit, who grew up in the remote Northwest Alaska village of Ambler, says he's not sure what he would have done without the mine.
Oh, man. That's really hard to say. I don't see what other opportunities there would be, you know, and so if this place didn't exist, it would be very, very difficult.
In a region without another major economic base, high-paying jobs outside the government are scarce. Red Dog's salaries can pay six figures, and hundreds of NANA shareholders work there, a little more than half the workforce. Petit has invested more than $100,000 from his Red Dog earnings into a business in his village, which takes tourists hiking, fishing, and caribou viewing in Kobuk Valley National Park. His job also pays for equipment and the expensive gas he and his family members need for their subsistence harvests.
To go down the river to get some caribou or go get some fish, getting firewood, you know, all that. Since we've merged with a Western-type culture, everything needs cash funding. It's just required now.
Petit isn't the only one who credits Red Dog with sustaining subsistence activities. So does Human Resources Director Cole Schaefer. Each summer, Schaefer transfers his residence, So instead of flying him back to his home near Anchorage after each shift, Red Dog takes Schaefer to the village of Kayana, where he can access his subsistence fishing cabin. He says Red Dog's weeks on, weeks off schedule fits for him because it leaves big blocks of time for harvests, which makes the mine essential in sustaining the region's villages and subsistence lifestyles, he says.
It doesn't matter whether it's in the Nana region or any other region in rural Alaska, right? You know, you have to have economic engines to help support and sustain communities. Otherwise, it makes it the burden of a government.
Not everyone in the Northwest Arctic sees Red Dog the same way. Some say the shift work pulls people away from their families and actually leaves less time for subsistence. Others say there's enough work in the region's communities for people to pay their bills without mining jobs. And residents of Kivalina, the only village downstream from the mine, say they've suffered outsized impacts while benefiting little. Millie Hawley, the administrator for Kivalina's tribal government, says residents' beluga and berry harvests have had to change. While the state says Red Dog's discharge is too diluted to be detected by the time it flows past the village, Hawley says residents are still worried about their drinking water.
The state benefit, the burr benefit, the people in the non-regional shareholders benefited, but Kivalina has taken the brunt of it all.
Studies, meanwhile, have shown major economic benefits from Red Dog. It generates tens of millions of dollars in wages for Nana shareholders each year, and it's provided more than 10% of jobs in most regional villages. Here's University of Alaska Anchorage researcher Bob Leffler.
It's one of the major structures holding up the economy and holding up income in the region.
Which is why there's increasing anxiety about what happens when Red Dog runs out of ore to mine, something that's expected in about a decade. The local borough government, which gets the vast majority of its revenue from Red Dog, has been exploring alternative industries like green energy and tourism. But Nana Vice President of Natural Resources Lance Miller says those industries won't carry the region.
Would we like to have diversification? Absolutely. And Nana as a business does too. But as long as we can reasonably have a viable economic engine based on assets on our land, it's hard to see something else of that magnitude.
Red Dog is crucial for Nana and Northwest Alaska, but the mine's benefits actually extend far beyond the region, and so would the impacts if it closes. That's because of provisions in the Native Claims Settlement Act that call for regional corporations to redistribute 70% of their natural resource revenues with other regional and village corporations. Money from Red Dog represents a huge chunk of that shared revenue statewide, which means that some small village corporations depend on the mine to balance their yearly budgets. Nathan McCowan chairs a group that represents village corporations. He says the disappearance of the revenue sharing cash, known as 7J money, could force actions like selling of lands.
7J keeps a number of the village corporations rolling as going concerns without having to really face extraordinarily difficult existential questions.
Red Dog's closure in 2032 is not certain. There's a major deposit 10 miles away that could extend the mine's life by decades. But Red Dog's operators say it will take years to find out if it's commercially viable. In the meantime, Nana and another mining company are exploring a possible new copper mine. Like Red Dog, it could create hundreds of jobs and hundreds of millions of dollars in income, but it also risks impacts to the region's fish and game. Thanks for listening to Unsettled, a podcast about the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. It's part of a reporting collaboration between Alaska Public Media, Indian Country Today, and the Anchorage Daily News. The series was edited by Julia O'Malley with help from David Hewlin, Annie Feit, and Tegan Hanlon. Funding for the ANCSA project was provided by the Alaska Center for Excellence in Journalism. The podcast was produced by Annie Feit and Tobin Shelby. Megan Sullivan and Aaron Leggett generously agreed to co-host, and literally dozens of people helped make this project possible, among them Ryan Peterson, Jim Magdans, Greta Shirk, John Lincoln, Willard Comack, Sam Jones, Roger Franklin, Lauren Gentleman, Shalon Harrington, Jeff Seifert, Lauren Holmes, Ann Raup, DJ Fowski, Tara Sweeney, Richard Glenn, Charles Vidulo, Jacob Resnick, Natalie Dawson, Megan Alvana Stimple, and Margie Deshevsky. Thank you.